This podcast is part of the Neverland Network, where faith meets video games, movies, and fun. Find more shows like this at neverlandpodcast.com.
From days long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend.
The dream that came through a million years, that lived on through all the tears.
It came here, the Fandom Nexus.
Fabulous secret powers were revealed to our host as he plugged in his microphone.
I have a podcast!
Here he is, your Spider-Pan, Jeremy.
Hello, thank you so much for joining me on part one of a very special Christmas version of the podcast of the Fandom Nexus. This is going to be kind of special. We'll have some ads probably in here that you can still avoid by being part of a Patreon. This is very, very special. And please do not consider this to be like an audiobook, but we're going to read for you a Christmas carol. And this is going to be more like if me and some friends sat here with you and read the book. And because I have different people, we were providing different voices. But it's going to be more like us sitting around and reading the book to you. And because occasionally we commented on things or made a mistake. And I edited to a degree of anything where something went really wrong. Or like I was coughing or something like that. I'm going to try to edit that out. But occasionally we just kind of laughed at something or, you know, and I thought, well, that's more friendly. And this is for fun. And it's not intended to be an audiobook in any way, shape or form. It's just us sitting around and sharing a fantastic classic book with you that, heck, if you want to read along with this, if you have a copy of this, in fact, it's part of public domain. If you can get a full version of it, because, you know, there are Reader's Digest abridged versions out there, you know. If you can get a full version, if you want to like read along with us, that's fine. But I'm going to present this in two parts because otherwise it's very, very long. And as it is, I'm still editing parts. The next part for the staves or staves, I think you call it in these. 3, 4, and 5. I think I still need to put together and record some of it. But I wanted to get something out to you before Christmas, and we'll probably get the rest of it maybe later this week. I wanted you just to enjoy this and. This will get you through about halfway through the book. And I do want to thank Paul J. Powers, who was able to join us for this part of the program from the Retro Rewind podcast as part of Firelight Studios. I believe you can find them at firelight.com. I should have looked that up before we got started. I do apologize for that. But yeah, check out for Paul J. Powers and Retro Rewind. You can find links for that actually at neverlandpodcast.com. If you look to some of our links, I believe I've got a logo for them and you can check them out. Hopefully my link is still good to get them over. But yeah, definitely check them out. They go in that they watch old movies that are at least 15 years old and review them and talk about what they like, what they dislike, and usually have some guests with them. It's a fun show. I've enjoyed it. I've only been listening to them, I think, maybe a year, maybe two. Something like that, but I have enjoyed it, and I do tend to skip over if I have not seen the movie because they'll spoil it for you if you have not seen that movie. So I do recommend check out what movie they're covering before you go and listen, unless you don't mind having it spoiled, or if you don't plan to watch it at any time. I think you'll enjoy it more if you've watched the movie or show that they're talking about. But they have a lot of different things. Francisco even plays video games on their YouTube channel and live streams some stuff too, some old games and stuff like that. But anyways. Of course, I want to thank everybody who helped me out with this. You'll hear my wife's voice. You'll hear Pastor Philip from the Watching Movies with My Pastor podcast that I do with him. And also good old Eric will be showing up. Eric helped out a lot with this. He's been a trooper and doing a lot of different characters. And so you'll hear his voice as well. But I hope you enjoy this. I hope you have a Merry Christmas. I hope you your next year is going to be fantastic, even if you live in Missouri and you know that in 6 years the Chiefs will be playing over in Kansas. Yeah. That was a news story we didn't like around here. But okay, let's get on to it with Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Take it away, me. Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, Stave 1, Marley's Ghost. Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead
as a doornail.
I didn't know doornails were dead. Okay, moving on. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I was just saying that. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade, but the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it, or the country is done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat, emphatically, that Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead. Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for, I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, whatever that means, his sole friend and sole mourner. And even Scrooge was not so dreadfully cut up that by the sad event, but that he was an excellent man of business on the very day of the funeral and solemned it with his undoubted bargain. The mention of Marley's funeral brings me back to the point I started from. There is no doubt that Marley was dead. This must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of the story I'm going to relate. If we were not perfectly convinced that Hamlet's father died before the play began, there would be nothing more remarkable in his taking a stroll at night in the easterly wind upon his own ramparts than there would be any middle-aged gentleman rashly turning about after dark in a breezy spot, say St. Paul's Churchyard, for instance, literally to astonish his son's weak mind. Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name. There it stood, years afterwards, above the warehouse door. Scrooge and Marley. The firm was known as Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley. But he answered to both names. It was all the same to him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone with Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained, and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about him. He iced his office in the dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, no wintry weather chill him. No wind that blew the bitterer than he. No falling snow was more intent upon its purpose. No pelting rain less open to entreaty. Foul weather didn't know where to have him. The heaviest rain, the snow and hail and sleet could boast of the advantage over him in only one respect. They often came down handsomely, and Scrooge never did. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tuck their owners into doorways and up courts, and then would wag their tails as though they said, "No eye at all is better than an evil eye, dark master." But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked. That's what dogs sound like, didn't you know? Okay. To edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance, was what the knowing ones called nuts to Scrooge. Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was a cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement, stones to warm them. Sorry, that sounds better that way. The city clocks had only just gone three. Bong, bong, bong. But it was quite dark already. It had not been light all day, and candles were flaring in the windows of the neighboring offices like ruddy smears upon the palpable brown air. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without that all throughout the court was one of the narrowest, and the houses opposite were mere phantoms. To see the dingy cloud come drooping down, obscuring everything, one might have thought that nature lived hard by and was brewing on a large scale. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open. that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore the cloak put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed. Oh, okay, here comes Fred. A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you! Cried a cheerful voice. It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew. He came upon so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach.
Bah!
Said Scrooge.
Humbug. I'm sorry, I won't go back.
That's okay.
Bah!
Said Scrooge.
Humbug.
He had so heated himself with rapid walking in the fog and frost, this nephew of Scrooge's, that he was all in a glow. His face was ruddy and handsome. His eyes sparkled and his breath smoked again.
Christmas a humbug, uncle, said Scrooge's nephew. You don't mean that, I am sure.
I do,
said Scrooge.
Merry Christmas. What right have you to be merry?
Yep, you got lost. There we go.
What? Come then.
Whoop, no, you're still up here.
I'm sorry.
He says that same line twice. Let me turn it for you. There you go.
What right have you to be merry? You're poor enough.
Come then, returned the nephew gaily. What right have you to be dismal? What right have you to be morose? You're rich enough.
Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spot at the moment, said,
Bah!
Again, and followed it up with,
Humbug!
Don't be cross, uncle, said the nephew.
What else can I be?
Returned the uncle.
When I live in such a world with fools, as to wish Merry Christmas I'm sorry, folks, let me start over again. What else can I be? When in which I live with such a world as fools as this, Merry Christmas Merry Christmas. What Christmas time to you but a time to paying bills without money, a time to finding yourself a year older but on an hour richer, a time for balancing your books and having every time in them through around dozen of months presented dead against you. If I could work my will,
said Scrooge, indignantly,
every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should.
Uncle, pleaded the nephew.
Nephew,
mourned the uncle sternly. Oh, return the uncle sternly. Sorry.
Keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine.
Keep it, repeated Scrooge's nephew. But you don't keep it.
Let me leave it alone then,
said Scrooge.
Much good may it do to you. Much good it may have done you.
Has ever done you. Yes.
There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited, I dare say, returned the nephew, Christmas among the rest. But I am sure I have always thought of Christmas time when it has come around, apart from the veneration due to its sacred name and origin. If anything belonging to it can be apart from that, as good a time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of, in the long calendar of the year, when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-in hearts freely, and to think of people below them as if they were really fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold and silver in my pocket, I believe it has done me good, and will do me good, and I say, God bless it. The clerk in the tank involuntarily applauded.
Becoming immediately sensible of the impropriety, he poked the fire and extinguished the last frail spark forever.
Let me hear another sound from you,
said Scrooge,
and you'll keep your Christmas by losing your situation. You're quite a powerful speaker, sir,
he added, turning to his nephew.
I wonder you don't go into Parliament.
Don't be angry, uncle. Come, dine with us tomorrow.
Scrooge said that he would see him. Yes, indeed, he did. He went to the whole length of the expression and said that he would see him in that extremity first.
But why?
Cried Scrooge's uncle. Oh, sorry. Why?
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I already said, but why?
Yeah, but say it again.
But why? Said Scrooge's nephew. Why?
Why did you get married?
Said Scrooge.
Because I fell in love.
Because you fell in love?
Growled Scrooge, as if that were the only thing in the world more ridiculous than a Merry Christmas.
Oh. Good you. Afternoon.
Nay, Uncle, but you never came to see me before that happened. Why give it a reason for not coming now?
Good afternoon,
said Scrooge. I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why cannot we be friends?
Good afternoon,
said Scrooge. I am sorry, with all of my heart, to find you in such resolute. We have never had any quarrel to which I have been a party, but I have made the trial in homage to Christmas, and I'll keep my Christmas honor to the last, or Christmas humor to the last. So, a Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon,
said Scrooge, and a Happy New Year.
Good afternoon,
said Scrooge. His nephew left the room without an angry word, notwithstanding. He stopped at the outer door to bestow greetings of the season on the clerk, who, cold as he was warmer than Scrooge, for he returned them cordially. Oh, that's Scrooge again.
Where are we at here?
Right there.
There's another fellow,
muttered Scrooge, who overheard him.
My clerk with 15 shillings a week and a wife and family talking about a Merry Christmas. I'll retire to Bedlam.
This lunatic, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands and bowed to him.
Scrooge and Molly's, I believe.
Oh, yeah, you jump in there, be one of them. That'll be good. said one of the gentlemen, referring to his list. Have the pleasure...
Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Molly?
Mr. Marley has been dead for these 7 years,
Scrooge replied.
He died 7 years ago this very night.
We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner,
said the gentleman, presenting his credentials. It certainly was, for they had been two kindred spirits. At the ominous word, liberality, Scrooge frowned and shook his head and handed the credentials back.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge,
said the gentleman, taking up a pen,
it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and the destitute, who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessities. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir.
Are there any prisons?
Asked Scrooge.
Plenty of prisons,
said the gentleman, laying down the pen again.
And the union workhouses,
demanded Scrooge.
Are they still in operation?
They are still,
returned the gentleman.
I wish I could say they were not.
The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor, then,
said Scrooge.
Both very busy, sir.
Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them from their useful course,
said Scrooge.
I'm very glad to hear it.
Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude,
returned the gentleman,
a few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We chose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance is open, or abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?
Nothing,
Scrooge replied.
You wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone,
said Scrooge.
Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, this is my answer. I don't make myself merry at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die,
said Scrooge,
they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, excuse me, I don't know that.
But you might know it,
observed the gentleman.
It's not my business,
Scrooge returned.
It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's mine occupation. Me, go back, I'm sorry. Mine occupies me constantly. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentleman withdrew. Scrooge resumed his labors with an improved opinion of himself and in a more facetious temper than was usual for him. Meanwhile, the fog and darkness thickened so that people ran about with flaring links, proffering their services to go before horses and carriages and conduct them on their way. The ancient tower of a church, whose gruff old bell was always peeping slyly down at Scrooge out of a gothic window in the wall, became invisible and struck the hours and quarters in the clouds with tremulous vibrations afterwards, as if its teeth were chattering and its frozen head up there. The cold became intense. In the main street at the corner of the court, some laborers were repairing the gas pipes and had lighted a great fire in the braziers. Round with a party of ragged men and boys were gathered, warming their hands and winking their eyes before the blaze in rapture. The water plug being left in solitude, its overflowing suddenly congealed and turned to misanthropic ice. The brightness of the shops where holly sprigs and berries crackled in the lamp heat of the windows made pale faces ruddy as they passed. Poulterers and grocers' trades became a splendid joke, a glorious pageant with which it was next to impossible to believe that such dull principles as bargain and sale had anything to do. The Lord Mayor, in the stronghold of the mighty mansion house, gave orders to his 50 cooks and butlers to keep Christmas as a Lord Mayor's household should, and even the little tailor, whom he had fined 5 shillings on the previous Monday for being drunk and bloodthirsty in the streets, stirred up to the tomorrow's pudding in his garret, while his lean wife and the baby sallied out to buy the beef. Foggier yet and colder, piercing, searching, biting cold. If the good Saint Dunstan had but nipped the evil spirit's nose with a touch of such weather as that, instead of using his familiar weapons, then indeed he would roar to lusty purpose. The owner of one scant young nose, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol. But at the first sound of, "God bless you, merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay," Scrooge seized the ruler of such energy of action that the singer fled in terror, leaving the keyhole to the fog and even more congenial frost. At the length of the hour of shutting up the counting house arrived, with an ill will, Scrooge dismounted from his stool and tacitly admitted the fact to the expectant clerk in the tank, who instantly snuffled his candle out and put on his hat. Or snuffed his candle out. I'm sorry.
"You want all the day tomorrow, I suppose,"
said Scrooge.
"If quite convenient, sir."
"It's not convenient,"
said Scrooge.
"And it's not fair. Yet if I was to stop half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used. I'll be bound."
The clerk smiled faintly.
"And yet,"
said Scrooge,
"you don't think me ill-used when I pay you a day's wages for no work."
The clerk observed that it was only once a year.
"A poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December,"
said Scrooge, buttoning his great coat to the chin.
"But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier the next morning."
The clerk promised that he would. I thought Bob Cratchit would have more lines than that. All right, the clerk promised that
me
he
too.
Would. And Scrooge walked out with a growl. The office was closed in a twinkling, and the clerk, the long ends of his white comforter dangling below his waist, for he boasted no great coat, went down a slide on Cornhill at the end of the lane of boys 20 times in honor of it being Christmas Eve, and then ran home to Camden Town as hard as he could pelt to play at Blindman's Bluff. So you're still having fun there, Bob. Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern, and having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, went home to bed. He lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner. Oh, that's creepy. Yeah, it is. They were a gloomy suite of rooms and a lowering pile of building up a yard where it had so little business to be that one could scarcely help fancying it must have run there when it was a young house, playing at hide and seek with other houses and forgotten the way out again. It was old enough now and dreary enough, for nobody lived in it but Scrooge, and other rooms being all let out as offices. The yard was so dark that even Scrooge, who knew its every stone, was fain to grope with his hands. The fog and frost so hung about the black old gateway of the house that it seemed as if the genius of the weather sat in mournful meditation on the threshold. Now, it is a fact that there was nothing at all particular about the knocker on the door, except that it was very large. It was also a fact that Scrooge had seen it night and morning during his whole residence in that place. Also, that Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the city of London, even including, which is a bold word, the corporation, aldermen, and livery. Let it also be borne in mind that Scrooge had not bestowed one thought on Marley since his last mention of his 7 years dead partner that afternoon. And then let any man explain to me, if he can, how it happened that Scrooge, having his key in the lock of the door, saw in the knocker, without its undergoing any intermediate process of change, not a knocker, but Marley's face. Marley's face. It was Scrooge. Okay, it's not actually in the book, but I had to throw it in. It was not in an impenetrable shadow, as the other objects in the yard were, but had a dismal light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar. It was not angry or ferocious, but looked at Scrooge as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up on its ghostly forehead. The hair was curiously stirred, as if by breath or hot air. And though the eyes were wide open, they were perfectly motionless. That and its livid color made it horrible. But its horror seemed to be in spite of the face and beyond its control, rather than part of its own expression. As Scrooge looked fixedly at this phenomenon, it was a knocker again. To say that he was not startled, or that his blood was not conscious of a terrible sensation in which he had been stranger from infancy, would be untrue. But he put his hand upon the key he had relinquished, turned it sturdily, walked in, and lighted his candle. He did pause with a moment's irresolution before he shut the door, and he did look cautiously behind it first, as if he half expected to be terrified with the sight of Marley's pigtail sticking out into the hall. But there was nothing on the back of the door except the screws and nuts that held the knocker on. So he said,
"Pooh, pooh,"
and closed it with a bang. There, I snapped my fingers. That's the bang. The sound resounded through the house with a thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellars below appeared to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He fastened the door, walked across the hall and up the stairs slowly too, trimmed his candle as he went. You may talk vaguely about driving a coach and six up a good old flight of stairs or through a bad young act of parliament, but I mean to say you might have got a hearse up that staircase and taken it broadwise with the splinter bar towards the wall and the door towards the balustrades and done it easy. There was plenty of width for that and more to spare, which is perhaps the reason why Scrooge thought he saw a locomotive hearse going on before him in the gloom. Half a dozen gas lamps out of the street wouldn't have lighted the entry too well, so as you may suppose that it was pretty dark with Scrooge's dip. Up Scrooge went, not caring a button for that. Darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it. But before he shut his heavy door, he walked through the rooms to see that all was right. He had just enough recollection of the face to desire to do that. Sitting room, bedroom, lumber room, all as they should be. Nobody under the table, nobody under the sofa. Small fire in the grate, spoon and basin ready, and the little saucepan of gruel, Scrooge had a cold in his head, upon the hob. Nobody under the bed, nobody in the closet, nobody in his dressing gown, which was hanging up in a suspicious attitude against the wall. Lumber room as usual, old fire guard, old shoes, two fish baskets, washing stand on three legs, and a poker. Quite satisfied, he closed his door and locked himself in. Double locked himself in, which was not his custom. Thus secured against surprise, he took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers and his nightcap, and sat down before the fire to take his gruel. It was a very low fire indeed, nothing on such a bitter night. He was obliged to sit close to it and brood over it before he could extract the least sensation of warmth from such a handful of fuel. The fireplace was an old one, built by some Dutch merchant long ago, and paved all around with quaint Dutch tiles designed to illustrate the scriptures. There were Cains and Abels, Pharaoh's daughters, queens of Sheba, angelic messengers descending through the air on clouds like feather beds. Abraham, Belshazzars, apostles putting off to sea in butter boats, hundreds of figures to attract his thoughts. And yet, that face of Marley, 7 years dead, came like the ancient prophet's rod and swallowed up the whole. If each smooth tile had been a blank at first, with power to shape some picture on its surface from the disjointed fragments of his thoughts, there would have been a copy of old Marley's head on every one. Yeah, that's you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I got to stop for a second. Try to catch myself.
Scrooge was about to laugh.
What happened was, I'm so used to the films, and every single film where he looks behind the door, he says humbug.
Yeah.
Every film. Well, I was about to say humbug because I thought this was what he was pointing at. Then I look and see, and it says poo, comma, poo. So I yell, poo-poo. I just yell poo-poo because that's what I saw, poo-poo.
When I didn't realize it's spelled with an H, folks. He's not talking about poop.
I know, but when I saw that, well, we can cut that out. But what I saw was...
I'm going to keep it in. This is entertainment.
No. Well, I realized the way
and
I said
it. And where's
Piglet? Yeah, that's exactly. What I say. I'm fine with that. But when I said it, it sounded like I was saying something else. I'm like, wait a minute. Scrooge is all talking about human weight. I don't like it. I'm so sorry.
He's poo-pooing the whole thing. Like,
But the way I said it, I should have put more of a comma. But I was so surprised with the way he said it. I wasn't used to it. My fault.
Did you say poo-poo?
I went poo-poo. And I was like, I don't like it. Anyway,
but as Scrooge is fond of saying.
Yes. Humbug,
said Scrooge and walked across the room. Remember, it's getting scary now. Quit laughing.
It's my fault.
All right. Scary. After several turns, he sat down again. As he threw his head back in the chair, his glance happened to rest upon a bell. A disused bell that hung in the room. And communicated for some purpose, now forgotten, with a chamber in the highest story of the building. It was with great astonishment and with a strange, inexplicable dread that as he looked, he saw this bell begin to swing. It swung so softly in the outset that it scarcely made a sound, but soon it rang out loudly, and so did every bell in the house. This might have lasted half a minute or a minute, but it seemed an hour. The bells ceased as they began together. They were succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain over the casks in the wine merchant's cellar. Scrooge then remembered to have heard that ghosts in haunted houses were described as dragging chains. The cellar door flew open with a booming sound, boom! And then he heard the noise much louder on the floors below, then coming up the stairs, then coming straight towards his house.
It's humbug still,
said Scrooge.
I won't believe it.
His color changed, though, when without a pause, it came on through the heavy door and passed into the room before his eyes. Upon its coming, and the dying flame leaped up as though it cried.
I know him, Marley's ghost,
and fell again. The same face, the very same. Marley in his pigtail, usual waistcoats, tights and boots, the tassels on the ladder bristling, like his pigtail and his coat skirts, and the wound, and his coat skirts, and the hair upon his head. The chain he drew was clasped about his middle. It was long and wound about him like a trail, and it was made, for Scrooge observed it closely, of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses wrought in steel. His body was transparent so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he had never believed it until now. There's no poo-poo here. Okay, no, nor did he believe it even now. Though he looked the phantom through and through, he saw it standing before him, though he felt the chilling influence of his death-cold eyes and marked the very texture of the folded kerchief bound about his head and chin, which wrapped, had he had not observed before, he was still incredulous and fought against his senses.
How now?
Said Scrooge, caustic and cold as ever.
What do you want with me?
Much, Marley's voice, no doubt about it.
Who are you?
Ask me who I was.
Who were you then?
Said Scrooge, raising his voice.
You're particular for a shade.
He was going to say to a shade, but substituted this as more appropriate.
In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley.
Can you sit down?
Asked Scrooge, looking doubtfully at him.
I can.
Do it then.
Scrooge asked the question because he didn't know whether a ghost so transparent might find himself in a condition to take a chair, and felt that in the events of his being impossible, it might involve the necessity of an embarrassing explanation. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace as if it were quite used to it.
You don't believe in me, observed the ghost.
I don't,
said Scrooge.
What evidence would you have of my reality beyond that of your own senses?
I don't know,
said Scrooge.
Why do you doubt your senses?
Because,
said Scrooge,
a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheat. You may be an undigested bit of beef, or a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of undigested potato. There's more of gravy than of gravy about you, whatever you are.
Scrooge was not in the habit of cracking jokes, nor did he feel in his heart by any means waggish then. The truth is that he tried to be smart as a means of distracting his own attention and keeping down his terror, for the specter's voice disturbed the very marrow to his bones. To sit, staring at those fixed glazed eyes in silence for a moment, would play, Scrooge felt, the very deuce with him. There was something very awful, too, in the specter's being provided with an infernal atmosphere of its own. Scrooge could not feel it himself, but this was clearly the case, for the ghost sat perfectly motionless. Its hair and skirts and tassels were agitated as by the hot vapor from an oven. That's Scrooge again.
Top of the page. You see this toothpick?
Said Scrooge, returning quickly to the charge, for the reason just assigned, and wishing, though it were only for a second, to divert this vision's stony gaze from himself.
I do,
replied the ghost.
You are not looking at it,
said Scrooge.
But I see it, said the ghost, notwithstanding.
Well,
returned Scrooge,
I have but to swallow this, and be for the rest of my days persecuted by a legion of goblins, all of my own creation. Humbug, I tell you, humbug!
At this, the spirit raised a frightful cry, and shook its chains, and with such dismal and appalling noise that Scrooge held on tight to his chair to save himself from falling into a swoon. But how much greater was his horror than the phantom taking off the bandage round his head, as if it were too warm to wear indoors, its lower jaw dropped down upon its breast. Scrooge fell upon his knees and clasped his hands before his face.
Mercy!
He said.
Dreadful apparition! Why do you trouble me?
Man of worldly mind, replied the ghost. Do you believe in me or not?
I do,
said Scrooge.
I must, why do spirits walk the earth? And why do they come to see me?
It is required of every man, the ghost returned, that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men and travel far and wide. And if that spirit goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death.
Pardon me while I sip some tea. Marley's voice is rough on the throat.
It says that in the book.
Yes, it does.
Marley sipped his tea. It is doomed to wander through the world. Oh, woe is me! And witness what it cannot share, but might have shared on earth, and turned to happiness.
Again, the specter raised a cry, and shook his chains, and wrung its shadowy hands.
You are fettered,
said Scrooge, trembling.
Tell me why.
I wear the chain I forged in life, replied the ghost. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it on one of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Its patterns strange to you?
Scrooge trembled more and more.
Or would you know, pursued the ghost, the weight and length of the strong coil you bear yourself. It was heavy and as long as this, 7 Christmas Eves ago. You have labored on it since. It is a ponderous chain.
Who needs a drink? I'm trying to do my best emperor impersonation, but I feel myself going Alec Guinness. Pardon me, folks.
Fitting.
Yes. Scrooge glanced about on him on the floor in the expectation of finding himself surrounded by some 50 or 60 fathoms of iron cable, but he could see nothing.
"Jacob,"
he said imploringly.
"Oh, Jacob Marley, tell me more. Speak comfort to me, Jacob."
"I have none to give," the ghost replied. "It comes from other regions, Ebenezer Scrooge, and is conveyed by other ministers to other kinds of men. Nor can I tell you what I would. A very little more is all permitted to me. I cannot rest. I cannot stay. I cannot linger anywhere. My spirit never walked beyond our counting house. Mark me, in life, my spirit never roved beyond the narrow limits of our money-changing hole, and weary journeys lie before me."
It was a habit with Scrooge, whenever he became thoughtful, to put his hands in the breeches of his pockets. Pondering on what the ghost had said, he did so now, but without lifting up his eyes or getting off his knees.
"You must have been very slow about it, Jacob,"
Scrooge observed, in a businesslike manner, though with humility and deference.
"Slow," the ghost repeated.
7 years dead,"
mused Scrooge.
"And traveling all the time?"
"The whole time," said the ghost. "No rest, no peace. Incessant torture of remorse."
"You travel fast?"
said Scrooge.
"On the wings of the wind," replied the ghost.
"You might have got over a great quantity of ground in 7 years,"
said Scrooge. The ghost, on hearing this, set up another cry and clanks its chains so hideously in the dead silence of the night that the ward would have been justified in indicting it for nuisance.
"Oh, captive bound in double iron," cried the phantom, "not to know the ages of incessant labor by immortal creatures. For this earth must pass into eternity before the good of which is susceptible is all developed. Not to know that any Christian spirit working kindly in its little sphere, whatever it may be, will find its mortal life too short for its vast means of usefulness. Not to know that no space of regret can make amends for one's life's opportunity misused. Yet such was I. Oh, such was I."
"But you were always a good man of business, Jacob,"
faltered Scrooge, who now began to apply this to himself.
"Business!" cried the ghost, wringing his hands again. "Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business."
It held up its chain at arm's length, as if that were the cause of all its unavailing grief, and flung it heavily upon the ground again, as he just dropped it.
"At this time of the rolling year," the specter said, "I suffer most. Why did I walk through the crowds of fellow beings with my eyes turned down, and never raise them so that blessed star which led the wise men to a poor abode? Were there no poor homes to which its light would have conducted me?"
Scrooge was very dismayed to hear the specter going on at this rate. He began to quake exceedingly.
"Hear me," cried the ghost. "My time is nearly gone."
"I will,"
said Scrooge.
"But don't be hard upon me. Don't be flowery, Jacob, pray."
"How is it that I appear before you in a shape that you can see? I may not tell. I have sat invisible beside you many and many a day."
It was not an agreeable idea, Scrooge shivered, and wiped the perspirations from his brow.
"That is no light part of my penance," pursued the ghost. "I am here tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate, a chance and hope of my procuring Ebenezer."
"You're always a good friend to me,"
said Scrooge.
"Thank you."
"You will be haunted," resumed the ghost, "by three spirits."
Scrooge's countenance fell almost as low as the ghost's had done.
Is that the chance and hope you mentioned, Jacob?"
he demanded in a faltering voice.
"It is."
I, I think I'd rather not,
said Scrooge. Without their visits, said the ghost, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tomorrow, when the bell tolls one.
Couldn't I take them all at once and have it over, Jacob?
Hinted Scrooge. Expect the second on the next night, at the same hour. The third upon the next night, when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate. Look to see me no more, and look that, for your own sake, you remember what has passed between us.
When it had said these words, the specter took to its wrapper from the table and bound it round its head as before. Scrooge knew this by the smart sound its teeth made when the jaws brought together by bandage. He ventured to raise his eyes again and found his supernatural visitor confronting him in erect attitude, with his chain wound over and about its arm. The apparition walked forward from him, and at every step it took, the window raised itself a little so that when the specter reached it, it was wide open. It beckoned Scrooge to approach, which he did. When they were within 2 paces of each other, Marley's ghost held up its hand, warning him to come no nearer. Scrooge stopped, not so much in obedience as in surprise and fear, for on the raising of the hand he became sensible of confused noises in the air, incoherent sounds of lamentation and regret, wailings inexpressible, sorrowful and self-accusatory. The specter, after listening for a moment, joined in the mournful dirge and floated out upon the bleak, dark night. Scrooge followed to the window, desperate in his curiosity. He looked out. The air was filled with phantoms, wandering hither and thither in restless haste, the moaning as they went. Every one of them wore chains like Marley's ghost. Some few, they might be guilty of governments, were linked together. None were free. Many had been personally known to Scrooge in their lives. He had been quite familiar with one ghost, in a white waistcoat and a monstrous iron safe attached to its ankle, who cried piteously at being unable to assist a wretched woman with an infant whom it saw below upon a doorstep. The misery with them all was clearly that they sought to interfere for good in human matters and had lost the power forever. Whether those creatures faded into mist or mist enshrouded them, he could not tell, but they and the spirit voices faded together, and the night became as it would have been when he walked home. Scrooge closed the window and examined the door by which the ghost had entered. It was double locked, and as he locked it with his own hands, and the bolts were undisturbed, he tried to say, humbug. Yeah, right here. It's just a humbug.
Humbug!
But it stopped at the first syllable. So you didn't say humbug, you said
hum.
And being from the emotion he had undergone, or the fatigues of the day, or his glimpses of the invisible world, or the dull conversation of the ghost, or the lateness of the hour, much in need of repose, he went straight to bed without undressing and fell asleep upon the instant.
He-Man and the Masters of the Universe will be back right after these messages. And now back to He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Stave 2, the first of the three spirits. When Scrooge awoke, it was so dark that looking out of bed, he could scarcely distinguish the transparent window from the opaque walls of his chamber. He was endeavoring to pierce the darkness with his ferret eyes. I didn't know he had a ferret in bed with him. When the chimes of the neighboring church struck the 4 quarters, so he listened for the hour. To his great astonishment, the heavy bell went on from 6 to 7, and from 7 to 8, and regularly up to 12, then stopped. 12! It was past 2 when he went to bed. The clock was wrong. An icicle must have gotten into the works. 12! He touched the spring of his repeater to correct this most preposterous clock. Its rapid little pulse beat 12 and stopped.
Why, it is impossible,
said Scrooge,
that I can have slept through a whole day and far into another night. It is impossible that anything has happened to the sun, and this is 12 at noon?
The idea being an alarming one, he scrambled out of bed and groped his way to the window. He was obliged to rub the frost off with his sleeve of his dressing gown before he could see anything, and could see very little then. All he could make out was that it was still very foggy and extremely cold, and that there was no noise of people running to and fro, and making a great stir, as there were unquestionably would have been if night had been beaten off bright day and then taken possession of the world. This was a great relief, because 3 days after sight of his first days of exchange pay to Mr. Ebenezer Scrooge or his order and so forth would have become a mere United States security if there were no days to count by. Scrooge went to bed again and thought and thought and thought it over and over and over and could make nothing of it. The more he thought, the more perplexed he was, and the more he endeavored not to think, the more he thought. Marley's ghost bothered him exceedingly. Every time he resolved within himself, after mature inquiry, that it was all a dream, his mind flew back again, like a strong spring released to his first position. I love the descriptions on this. And presented the same problem to be worked all through. Was it a dream or not? Scrooge lay in his state until the chime had gone 3/4 more, when he remembered, on the sudden, that the ghost had warned him of a visitation when the bell tolled 1. He resolved to lie awake until the hour was past, and, considering that he could no more go to sleep than go to heaven, this was perhaps the wisest resolution in his power. The quarter was so long that he was more than once convinced he must have sunk into a doze unconsciously and missed the clock. At length, it broke upon his glistening ear, or listening ear. Oh, yeah, his ears were glistening like his eyes, or kind of like my eyes right near. Sometimes that happens when it's been cold and I got allergy in my eyes. Okay. Who wants to be ding dong?
I can ding dong.
I think Eric just did. All right, oh, okay. So he ding dong.
Ding dong.
Scrooge. 1/4 past,
said Scrooge, counting.
Ding dong.
1/2 past,
said Scrooge.
Ding dong.
1/4 to it. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry, Scrooge.
1/4 to it,
said Scrooge. I got distracted.
Ding dong.
The hour itself,
said Scrooge triumphantly.
And nothing else.
He spoke before the hour bell sounded, which it now did with a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy 1.
1.
Light flashed up into the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand. Not the curtains at his feet, nor the curtains at his back, but those to which his face was addressed. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge, staring up into a half-recumbent attitude, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor who drew them, as close to it as I am now to you, and I am standing in the spirit at your elbow. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as like an old man, viewed through more some supernatural medium, which gave him the appearance of having receded from the view and being diminished into a child's proportions. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on its skin. The arms were very long and muscular, the hands the same, as if it were of uncommon strength. Its legs and feet, most delicately formed, were, like those upper members, bare. It wore a tunic, and of the purest white, and round its waist was bound a lustrous belt, the sheen of which was beautiful. It held a branch of fresh green holly in its hand, and in a singular contradiction of that wintry emblem, had its dress trimmed with summer flowers. But the strangest thing about it was that from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light, by which all of this was visible, and which was doubtless the occasion of its using, in its duller moments, a great extinguisher for a cap, which it now held under its arm. I'm tearing up. This is an emotional story. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. For some reason, it makes me think of my wife. Gee, I wonder why.
Do I look like an old yet young man?
Yeah, because isn't it the musical Scrooge? It is an older lady. So you never know what you get. The most accurate depiction was actually Jim Carrey in the Disney version. Anyways.
He was horrible.
I kind of liked it. We only watched it once,
though. Onward.
Onward. Even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. For as its belt sparkled and glittered now in one part and now in another, and what was light one instant was another time was dark, so the figure itself fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, now a head without a body, of which dissolving parts, no outline would be visible in the dense gloom wherein they melted away. And in the very wonder of this, it would be itself again, distinct and clear as ever.
Are you a spirit, sir, whose coming was foretold to me?
Asked Scrooge.
I am.
The voice was soft and gentle, singularly low, as if instead of being so close beside him, it were at a distance.
Who and what are you?
Scrooge demanded.
I am the ghost of Christmas past.
Long past?
Inquired Scrooge, observant of its dwarfish stature.
No, your past.
Perhaps Scrooge could not have told anybody why, if anybody could have asked him, but he had a special desire to see the spirit in his cap and begged him to be covered.
What?
Exclaimed the ghost.
Would you so soon put out with worldly hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you are one of those whose passions made this cap and forced me through the whole trains of years to wear it low upon my brow?
Scrooge reverently disclaimed all intention to offend or any knowledge of having willfully bonneted the spirit at any point of his life or any period of his life. And he then made bold to inquire what business brought him there.
Your welfare,
said the ghost. Scrooge expressed himself much obliged, but could not help thinking that a night of unbroken rest would have been much more conducive to that end. The spirit must have heard him thinking, for it said immediately,
Your reclamation, then. Take heed.
It put out its strong hand as it spoke and clasped him gently on the arm, or by the arm, sorry.
Rise and walk with me.
It would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted to pedestrian purposes, that bed was warm and that the thermometer a long way below freezing, that he was clad but lightly in his slippers, dressing gown, and nightcap, and that he had a cold upon him at that time. The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit made towards the window, clasped his robe in supplication.
I am immortal,
Scrooge remonstrated,
and liable to fall.
Bear but a touch of my hand there,
said the spirit, laying it upon his heart,
and you shall be upheld in more than this.
As the words were spoken, they passed through the wall and stood upon an open country road with fields on either hand. The city had entirely vanished. Not a vestige of it was to be seen. The darkness and the mist had vanished with it. For it was a clear, cold winter day with snow upon the ground.
Good heaven,
said Scrooge, clasping his hands together as he looked about him.
I was bred in this place. I was a boy here.
The spirit gazed upon him mildly. Its gentle touch, though it had been light and instantaneous, appeared still present to the old man's sense of feeling. He was conscious of 1,000 odors floating in the air, each one connected with 1,000 thoughts and hopes and joys and cares. Long, long forgotten.
Your lip is trembling,
said the ghost.
And what is that upon your cheek?
Scrooge muttered, with an unusual catching in his voice, that it was a pimple, and begged the ghost to lead him where he would.
You recollect the way?
Inquired the spirit.
Remember it?
Cried Scrooge with fervor.
I could walk it blindfold.
Strange to have forgotten it for so many years,
observed the ghost.
Let us go on.
They walked along the road, Scrooge recognizing every gate and post and tree until a little market town appeared in the distance, with its bridge, its church, and winding river. Some shaggy ponies now and then seemed trotting towards them, with boys upon their backs who called to other boys in country gigs and carts, driven by farmers. All these boys were in great spirits and shouted to each other until the broad fields were so full of merry music that the crisp air laughed to hear it.
These are but shadows of the things that have been,
said the ghost.
They have no consciousness of us.
That's a weird word. The jocund travelers came on, and as they came, Scrooge knew and named them every one. Why, he was rejoiced beyond all bounds to see them. Why did his cold eye glisten and his heart leap as they went past? Why was he filled with gladness when he heard them give each other Merry Christmas as they parted to crossroads and byways for several homes? What was Merry Christmas to Scrooge? Out upon Merry Christmas, what good had it ever done to him?
The school is not quite deserted,
said the ghost.
A solitary child, neglected by his friends, is left there still.
Scrooge said he knew it, and he sobbed. They left the high road by a well-remembered lane and soon approached a mansion of dull red brick with a little weathercock surmounted cupola on the roof and bell hanging in it. It was a large house, but one of the broken fortunes, for the spacious offices were little used, their walls were damp and mossy, their windows broken, and their gates decayed. Fowls clucked and strutted in the stables, and the coach houses and sheds were overrun with grass. Nor was it more retentive of his ancient state within, for entering the dreary hall and glancing through the open doors of many rooms, they found them poorly furnished, cold, and vast. There was an earthly savor in the air, a chilly bareness in the place, which associated itself somehow with too much getting up by candlelight and not much to eat. They went, the ghost and Scrooge, across the hall to a door at the back of the house. It opened before them and disclosed a long, bare, melancholy room, made barer still by lines of plain deal forms and desks. At one of these, a lonely boy was reading near a feeble fire, and Scrooge sat down upon a form and wept to see his poor forgotten self as he used to be. Not a latent echo in the house, not a squeak and scuffle from the mice behind their paneling, not a drip from the half-thawed waterspout in the dull yard behind, not a sigh among the leafless boughs of one despondent poplar, not the idle swinging of an empty storehouse door, no, not a clicking in the fire, but fell upon the heart of Scrooge with a softening influence and gave a freer passage to his tears. The spirit touched him on the arm and pointed to his younger self, intent upon his reading. Suddenly, a man in foreign garments, wonderfully real and distinct to look at, stood outside the window with an axe stuck to his belt and leading by the bridle an ass laden with wood.
"Why, it's Alibaba,"
Scrooge exclaimed in ecstasy.
"It's dear old honest Alibaba. Yes, yes, I know. One Christmas time when yonder solitary child was left here all alone, he did come for the first time, just like that poor boy. And Valentine,"
said Scrooge,
"and his wild brother Orson, there they go. And what's his name? Who was put down in his drawers, asleep at the gate of the Damascus? Don't you see him? And the Sultan's groom turned aside down by the genie. There he is upon his head. Serve him right, I'm glad of it. What business had he to be married to the princess?"
To hear Scrooge expanding on all the earnestness of his nature on such subjects in a most extraordinary voice between laughing and crying, and to see his heightened and excited face would have been a surprise to his business friends in the city, indeed.
"There's the parrot,"
cried Scrooge.
"Green body and yellow tail, with a thing like lettuce growing out of the top of his head. There he is, poor Robin Crusoe, he called them. When he came home again after sailing around the island, poor Robin Crusoe. Where have you been, Robin Crusoe?" The man thought he was dreaming, but he wasn't. "It was the parrot, you know. There goes Friday, running for his life to the little creek. Hello, hoop hula."
Then, with a rapidity of transition very foreign to his usual character, he said, in pity for his former self,
"Poor boy,"
and cried again.
"I wish,"
Scrooge muttered, putting his hand in his pocket and looking about him after drying his eye with his cuff.
"But it's too late now."
"What is the matter?"
asked the spirit.
"Nothing,"
said Scrooge.
"Nothing. There was a boy singing a Christmas carol at my door last night. I should like to give him something, that's all."
The ghost smiled thoughtfully and waved its hand, saying as it did so,
"Let us see another Christmas."
Scrooge's former self grew larger at the words, and the room became a little darker and more dirty. The panels shrunk, the windows cracked, fragments of plaster fell out of the ceiling, and the naked lass were shown instead. But how all this was brought about, Scrooge knew no more than you do. He only knew that it was quite correct that everything had happened, so that there he was, alone again, when all the other boys had gone home for the jolly holidays. He was not reading now, but walking up and down despairingly. Scrooge looked at the ghost, and with a mournful shaking of his hand or head, glanced anxiously towards the door. It opened, and a little girl, much younger than the boy, came darting in and putting her arms around his neck and often kissing him, addressed him as her
dear brother. I have come to bring you home, dear brother,
said the child, clapping her tiny hands and bending down to laugh.
To bring you home, home.
One home, more little fan.
Return yes. the boy,
said the child. They're not giving me a chance to narrate, people. All right, brimful with glee.
Home for good and all. Home forever and ever. Father is so much kinder than he used to be. And home's like heaven. He spoke so gently to me one dear night when I was going to bed that I was afraid to ask him once more if you might come home. And he said, yes, you should send me the coach to bring you. And you're to be a man,
said the child, opening her eyes.
And you are never to come back here. But first, we're going to be together all Christmas long and have the merriest time in all the world.
You are quite a woman, little fan,
exclaimed the boy. She clapped her hands and laughed and tried to touch his head, but being too little, laughed again and stood on tiptoe to embrace him. Then she began to drag him in her childish eagerness towards the door, and he, nothing loth to go, accompanied her. A terrible voice in the hall cried,
bring down Master Scrooge's box there.
And in the hall appeared the schoolmaster himself, who glared on Master Scrooge with a ferocious condescension. Sorry, it was raining, okay? It was raining. And threw him into a dreadful state of mind by shaking hands with him, or probably snowing. Okay. He then conveyed him and his sister into the veriest old well of a shivering best parlor than ever was seen, where the maps upon the wall and the celestial terrestrial globes in the windows were waxy with cold. Here he produced a decanter of curiously light wine and a block of curiously heavy cake and administered installments of those dainties onto the young people, at the same time sending out a meager servant to offer a glass of something to the postboy, who answered that he thanked the gentleman. But if it was the same tap he had tasted before, he had rather not. Master Scrooge's trunk being by this time tied up on the top of the chase, I think that's how you say that, the children bade the schoolmaster goodbye, right willingly, and getting into it, drove gaily down the garden sweep and quick wheels dashing the hoar frost and snow from the dark leaves, all the evergreens like spray.
Always a delicate creature, whom a breath might have withered,
said the ghost.
But she had a large heart.
So she had,
cried Scrooge.
You're right. I will not gainsay it. Spirit, God forbid.
She died a woman,
said the ghost,
and had, as I think, children.
One child,
Scrooge returned.
True,
said the ghost.
Your nephew.
Scrooge seemed uneasy in his mind and answered briefly. Although they had but that moment left, the school behind them, they were now in the busy thoroughfares of a city, where shadowy passengers passed and repassed, where shadowy carts and coaches battled for the way, and all the strife and tumult of a real city were. It was made plain enough by the dressing of the shops that here, too, it was Christmas time again. But it was evening, and the streets were lighted up. The ghost stopped at a certain warehouse door and asked Scrooge if he knew it.
Know it?
Said Scrooge.
Was I apprenticed here?
They went in. At sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig sitting behind such a high desk, that if he had been 2 inches taller, he must have knocked his head against the ceiling. Scrooge cried in great excitement.
Why, it's old Fezziwig. Bless his heart, it's Fezziwig alive again.
Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and looked up from the clock, which pointed to the hour of 7. He rubbed his hands, adjusted his capacious waistcoat, laughed all over himself from his shoes to his organ of benevolence, and called out in a comfortable, oily, rich, fat, jovial voice,
Yo-ho there, Ebenezer, Dick!
Scrooge, what was it we were watching? Never mind. Yeah, the play goes wrong where somebody's name was Richard. Yeah, they made a joke of it. Okay, sorry. Scrooge's former self, that's why this is comedy, folks. Scrooge's former self, now grown a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow pretense. Prentice. It's apprentice with an apostrophe. Yeah. That's your line, Scrooge.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see it.
Yeah,
Dick Wilkins, to be sure,
said Scrooge to the ghost.
Bless me, yes, there he is. He was very much attached to me, was Dick, poor Dick, dear, dear.
Yo-ho, my boys,
said Fizzywig.
No more work tonight. Christmas Eve, Dick. Christmas, Ebenezer. Let's have the shutters up,
cried old Fizzywig with a sharp clap of his hands.
Before a man can say Jack Robinson.
You wouldn't believe how these two fellows went at it. They charged into the streets with the shutters. One, two, three, had them up in their places. Four, five, six, barred them and pinned them. Seven, eight, and nine, and came back before you could have got to 12, panting like racehorses.
Hilly-ho!
Cried old Fezziwig, skipping down from the high desk with wonderful agility.
Clear way, me lads, and let's have lots of room here. Hilly-ho, Dick, cheer up, Ebenezer.
Clear away. There was nothing they wouldn't have cleared away or couldn't have cleared away with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. Every movable was packed off as if it were dismissed from public life forevermore. The floor was swept and watered. The lamps were trimmed. Fuel was heaped upon the fire. And the warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler with a music book and went up to the lofty desk and made an orchestra of it. And tuned like 50 stomach aches. That sounds like it's really bad music. Tuned like 50 stomach aches?
It was a fiddle.
I guess. He got down the fiddle and he got down the bow. Okay. Anyways, in came Mrs. Fezziwig. One vast, substantial smile. In came the three Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the six young followers whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. And it came, in came the housemaid with her cousin, the baker. In came the cook with her brother's particular friend, the milkman. In came the boy from over the way who was, I know the way they talk about this with a particular friend. Anyway, who was suspected of not having board enough from his master, trying to hide himself behind the girl from next door. But one who was proved to have had her ears pulled by her mistress. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some gracefully. Some awkwardly, that would be me. Some pushing, that's some of the kids at recess today. Some pulling in the way they all came. Anyhow and everyhow. Away they all went, 20 couple at once, hands half round and back against the other way, down the middle and up again, round and round in various stages of affectionate grouping. Old top couple always turning up in the wrong place. Now new top couple starting off again. December the 25th. The song's in my head. The song's in my head. As soon as they got there, all top couples at last and not a bottom one to help them. When this result was brought about, old Fezziwig, clapping his hands to stop the dance, cried out,
"Well done!"
And the fiddler plunged his hot face into a pot of porter, especially provided for that purpose. But scorning rest upon his reappearance, he instantly began again, though they were no dancers yet, as if the other fiddler had just been carried home. Exhausted on a shutter, and he was brand new. Man resolved to beat him out of sight or perish. There were no more dances. There were more dances, and there were forfeits and more dances, and there was cake, and there was negus, whatever that is, and there was a great piece of cold roast, and there was a great piece of cold boiled, and there were mince pies and plenty of beer. But the great effect of the evening came after the roast and boiled, when the fiddler, an artful dog, mind, the sort of man who knew his business better than you or I could have told it him, struck up Sir Roger de Coverley. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig, top couple too, with a good sniff piece of work cut out for them, and three or four 20 pair of partners, people who were not to be trifled with, people who would dance and had no notion of walking. But if they had been twice as many, four times, old Fezziwig would have been a match for them, and so would Mrs. Fezziwig. As to her, she was worthy to be his partner in every sense of the term. I need to take a breath. This has been a lot, and I've been reading fast. If it's not high praise, tell me higher, and I'll use it. I think my belly's been dancing with everybody else. A positive light appeared to issue upon Fezziwig's calves. They shone in every part of the dance like moons. You couldn't have predicted at any given time what would have become of them next. And when old Fezziwig and Mrs. Fezziwig had gone all through the dance, advance and retire, both hands to your partner, bow and curtsy, corkscrew thread the needle, and back again to your place, Fezziwig's cut was so deftly that he appeared to wink with his legs and came upon his feet again without a stagger. When the clock struck 11, the domestic ball broke up. Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations, one on either side of the door, and shaking hands with every person individually as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas. When everybody had retired but the two apprentices, they did the same to them, and thus the cheerful voices died away, and the lads were left to their beds, which were under a counter to the back shop. During the whole of this time, Scrooge had acted like a man out of his wits. His heart and soul were in the scene, and with his former self, he corroborated everything, remembered everything, enjoyed everything, and underwent the strangest agitation. It was not until now, when the bright faces of his former self and Dick were turned from them, that he remembered the ghost and became conscious that it was looking full upon him, while the light upon its head burnt very clear.
"A small matter,"
said the ghost,
"to make these silly folks so full of gratitude."
"Small,"
echoed Scrooge. The spirit sighed to him to listen with the two apprentices, who were pouring out their hearts in praise of Fezziwig, and when he had done so, said,
"Why, is it not? Has he spent but few pounds of your mortal money? 3 or 4, perhaps. Is that so much he deserves this praise?"
"It isn't that,"
said Scrooge, heated by the remark, and speaking unconsciously like his former, not his latter self.
"It isn't that, spirit. He has the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome. A pleasure or a toil, say that his power lies in words and looks, and in this so slight and infashionate insufficient that it is impossible to add or count them up, and that then the happiness he gives is quite as great as if it cost a fortune."
He felt the spirit's glance and stopped.
"What is the matter?"
asked the ghost.
"Nothing particular,"
said Scrooge.
"Something, I think,"
the ghost insisted.
"No,"
said Scrooge.
"No, I should like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk just now, that's all."
His former self turned down the lamps as he gave utterance to the wish, and Scrooge and the ghost again stood side by side in the open air.
"My time grows short,"
observed the spirit.
"Quick."
This was not addressed to Scrooge or to anyone whom he could see, but it produced an immediate effect. For again, Scrooge saw himself. He was older now, a man in the prime of his life. His face had not the harsh and rigid lines of later years, but it had begun to wear the signs and care and avarice. There was an eager, greedy, restless motion in the eye, which showed the passion that had taken root and where the shadow of the growing tree would fall. He was not alone, but sat by the side of a fair young girl in a mourning dress, and whose eyes were, there were tears, which sparkled in the light that shone out of the ghost of Christmas past.
"It matters little,"
she said softly.
"To you, very little. Another idol has displaced me, and it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, as I would have tried to do. I have no just cause what to grieve."
"What idol has displaced you?"
he rejoined.
"A golden one."
"This is the even-handed dealing of the world,"
he said.
"There's nothing on which it has so has is so hard as poverty, and there is nothing is professes to condemn with such severity as the pursuit of wealth."
"You fear the world too much,"
she answered gently.
"All your hopes have merged beyond the hope of being beyond the chance of its sordid reproach. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one, till the master passion, gain, engrosses you. Have I not?"
"What then?"
he retorted.
"Even if I have grown so much wiser, what then? I am not changed towards you."
She shook her head.
"Am I?"
"Our contract was an old one. It was made when we were both poor and content to be so, until in good season we could improve our worldly fortunes by our patient industry. You are changed. When it was made, you were another man."
"I was a boy,"
he said impatiently.
"Your own feelings tell you that you are not what you are,"
she returned.
"I am that which promised happiness when we were one in heart is fraught with misery now that we are two. How often and how keenly I have thought of this, I will not say. It is enough that I have thought it and can release you."
"I have ever sought release?"
"In words, no, never."
"In what then?"
"In a changed nature, in an altered spirit, in another atmosphere of life, another hope, as its great end, and everything that made my love any worth or value in your sight, if this had ever never been between us,
said the girl, looking mildly but with steadiness upon him.
Tell me, would you seek me out and try to win me now? Oh, no.
He seemed to yield to the justice of this supposition in spite of himself, but he said with a struggle,
You think not.
I would gladly think otherwise if I could,
she answered.
Heaven knows, when I have learned the truth like this, I know how strong and irresistible it must be. But if you were free today, tomorrow, yesterday, can I even believe that you would choose a dowerless girl? You who, in your very confidence with her, weigh everything by gain. Or choosing her if for a moment you were false enough to your one guiding principle to do so, do I not know that your repentance and regret would surely follow? I do, and I release you with a full heart for the love of him you once were.
He was about to speak, but with her head turned from him, she resumed.
You may, the memory of what is past, have makes me hope you will, have pain in this, but very, very brief time, and you will dismiss the recollection of it gladly, as if an unprofitable dream from which it happened well that you awoke. May you be happy in the life you have chosen.
She left him, and they parted.
Spirit,
said Scrooge,
show me no more. Conduct me home. Why do you delight to torture me?
One shadow more,
exclaimed the ghost.
No more,
cried Scrooge.
No more. I don't wish to see it. Show me no more.
But the relentless ghost pinioned him in both his arms and forced him to observe what happened next. They were in another scene and place, a room, but not very large or handsome, but full of comfort. Near to the winter fire sat a beautiful young girl, so like that lass that Scrooge believed it was the same, until he saw her, now a comely matron, sitting opposite her daughter. The noise in this room was perfectly tumultuous, for there were more children there than Scrooge, in his agitated state of mind, could count. And unlike the celebrated herd in the poem, there were not 40 children conducting themselves like one, but every child was conducting itself like 40. The consequences were uproarious beyond belief, but no one seemed to care. On the contrary, the mother and daughter laughed heartily and enjoyed it very much, and the latter, soon beginning to mingle in the sports, got pillaged by the young brigands most ruthlessly. What would I not have given to be one of them? Though I never could have been so rude. No, no, I wouldn't for the wealth of all the world have crushed that braided hair and torn it down, and for my precious little shoe, I wouldn't have plucked it off. God bless my soul, to save my life. As to measuring her waist in sport as they did, bold young brood, I couldn't have done it. I should have expected my arm to have grown round it for punishment and never come straight again. And yet I should have dearly liked, I own, to have touched her lips, to have questioned her, that she might have opened them, to have looked upon the lashes of her downcast eyes and never raised a blush, to have let loose waves of hair, an inch of which would have be a keepsake beyond price. In short, I should have liked, I do confess, to have the lightest license of a child, and yet to have been a man enough to know its value. But now a knocking came at the door was heard. Sorry, I said that sentence really badly. But now a knocking at the door was heard, and such a rush immediately ensued that she, with laughing face and plundered dress, was borne towards it in the center of a flushed and boisterous group, just in time to greet the father, who came home attended by a man laden with Christmas toys and presents. Then the shouting and the struggling and the onslaught that was made on the defenseless boarder, the scaling him with chairs for ladders to dive into his pockets to spoil him of brown paper parcels, hold on tight by his cravat, hug him around the neck, pommel his back, and kick his legs in an irrepressible affection. The shouts of wonder and delight with which the development of every package was received, the terrible announcement that the baby had been taken in the act of putting the doll's frying pan into its mouth, eek, and what was more suspected of having swallowed a fictitious turkey glued on a wooden platter, the immense relief of finding this a false alarm, the joy and gratitude and the ecstasy, They were all indescribably alike. It is enough that by degrees the children and their emotions got out of the parlor and by one stair at a time up on the top of the house where they went to bed and so subsided. And now Scrooge looked on more attentively than ever when the master of the house, having his daughter leaning fondly on him, sat down with her and her mother at his own fireside. And when he went, or when he thought that such another creature, quite as graceful and as full of promise, might have called him father and been springtime in the haggard winter of his life, his sight grew very dim indeed.
"Belle,"
said the husband, turning to his wife with a smile.
"I saw an old friend of yours this afternoon."
"Who was it?"
"Yes."
"Well, how can I? Tut, I don't know,"
she added in the same breath, laughing as he laughed. That's still you.
"Oh, Mr. Scrooge?"
"Mr. Scrooge it was. I passed his office window and it was not shut up. And he had a candle inside. I could scarcely help seeing him. His partner lies on the point of death, I hear. And there he sat alone. Quite alone in the world, I do believe."
"Spirit,"
said Scrooge in a broken voice,
"remove me from this place."
"I told you these were shadows of things that have been,"
said the ghost.
"That they are what they are. Do not blame me."
"Remove me,"
Scrooge exclaimed.
"I cannot bear it."
He turned upon the ghost, and seeing that it looked upon him with a face in which in some way there were fragments of all the faces it had shown him, wrestled with it.
"Leave me. Take me back. Haunt me no longer."
In the struggle, if that can be called a struggle, in which the ghost, with no visible resistance on its own part, was undisturbed by any effort of its adversary, Scrooge observed that its light was burning high and bright, and dimly connected that with its influence over him. He seized the extinguisher cap, and by a sudden action, pressed it down upon its head. The spirit dropped beneath it, so that the extinguisher covered its whole form. But though Scrooge pressed it down with all of his force, he could not hide the light, which streamed from under it in an unbroken flood upon the ground. He was conscious of being exhausted and overcome by an irresistible drowsiness and further of being in his own bedroom. He gave the cap a parting squeeze, in which his hand relaxed and had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep.